Hi, and welcome to Talkword. I'm Marty. I'm joined here by Bob Eckstein, New York Times, two times best-selling author, New Yorker cartoonist.
No, just once. The Snowman book actually sold more books, but it wasn't a New York Times bestseller. It just proves that what the market's changed, because in 2007, it took a lot more to make the bestseller list, and people buy books so less now, so more, you know, so seldom, that I only sold a fraction of this copy. And
also a Mad Magazine illustrator.
I am.
Also Playboy?
Oh, used to be.
And National Lampoon cartoonist.
I used to do cartoons for the Lampoon before, and now I'm doing them now.
So welcome to the show. Thank you for being on Talkword.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. So this book just came out now. I have this book in front of me. Thank you for bringing it in. Footnotes from the World's Greatest Bookstores. And you illustrate the bookstores all over the world.
You're right. It started off just as a piece in the New Yorker. It was like this is a website piece, a small little piece that I really didn't think much of.
Mm-hmm.
It was about endangered bookstores in New York City. And the piece went viral the afternoon it got published. And my agent called me that afternoon and said, there's interest from Penguin Random House to do a book. And I was excited, got into it. And then after I started doing the book and meeting with bookstore owners, everything changed because I got really emotionally invested with the project. And I saw what a good cause it is. And I started really appreciating the plight of these bookstore owners, how hard it was for them to make a living. And then it became more of a project about raising awareness for independent bookstores.
How many bookstores are featured in this book?
There's 75. It started with 150. And what we did was we picked the best 75 like stories and best 75 bookstores. And
this guy's bookstore is in a van that I'm looking at right here. This is in Portugal.
There's a couple of bookstores like that.
It's called
Telestory. Always on the move. And this is a guy who rides around Spain. And you buy it out of his van. There's a couple of boats.
So it's like a bookmobile.
Yeah, a bookmobile. There's actually one in the book that's a tank. This guy reconfigured this tank to have 2,500 books that like are lined up on the outside of the tank.
Ah, I think I have. Is this the tank?
Yeah, it's in Argentina.
Weapon of Mass Instruction, Argentina.
Yeah.
It's a tank bookstore.
Yeah. The guy was, he does a very nice thing. He gave me actually a hard time about this book. He had his own list of conditions, like of what he wanted in return for help. And he wanted like 50 copies, and then he needed editorial approval, and then he wanted to write the piece.
I don't want bad representation of my tank bookstore in Argentina.
Yeah, he was being a prima donna, but he's a very nice guy what he's doing. But we had our things, but he has the tank, so I cowered down to him.
Did he buy that used? Where do you get a tank in Argentina?
eBay. No,
eBay.
You can get
anything on eBay.
There's a lot of things on eBay.
This is beautifully illustrated by you. Now, your process, how did you start being an illustrator? Like, where did you go to school? Did you always draw growing up?
Yeah.
You're from the Bronx?
I'm from the South Bronx, okay. And I drew. I was really into Sports Illustrated. I wasn't really into school, but Sports Illustrated back then, was filled with illustrations, not like now.
Are we talking like 60s, 70s type old school illustrations, unifying purple wash type?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Bernie Fuchs.
Yeah, Wolf, Bernie Fuchs.
Walt Spitzmiller. Bart Forbes was another guy. It was always my dream as a kid to illustrate for Sports Illustrated. And I actually did a job for them. I did a few jobs, but the last thing I did for them was the last like really big illustration job they even assigned. And I was going to do the cover, and it got bumped. Mickey Mantle died the night before the magazine was coming out. And instead of using my cover that was illustrating an expansion team in the NFL, they gave me a kill fee. And to give you an idea, back then, it was amazing. The money back then was totally different. When they did covers for Sports Illustrated or Time Magazine, they would hire like two or three people to do a cover. And they would pick the best. And then the losers would get a kill fee of like, let's say, I must have got like somewhere between $5 and $2,500.
Wow.
The winner would get $25,000 a cover.
$25,000?
That's how much you get paid for like a cover of a Time magazine. Or
holy moly.
Well, the money was totally different back then. So anyway, as a kid, I was really into
I did the cover of New York Press, and I was all excited because I got $300.
That's actually a lot for New York Press.
Yeah.
I used to do covers for the Village Voice, and then, yeah, they would pay under $1,000.
Yeah.
But those are, you know, alternative weeklies.
Yeah.
And now they're doing probably better than Time magazine and probably better than
probably. Yeah.
You know, Sports Illustrated's got a brand value, but doesn't have a publication value. And so as a kid, I liked illustration. I liked sports. And eventually I went to Pratt Institute.
Oh, you went to Pratt. I didn't know
that. Yeah. Yeah. I went to Pratt.
Pratt's a great school. I live right. I'm in Park Slope. So I'm very close to Fort Greene.
Okay. Well, it's much more beautiful now. When I went to school, it was dangerous.
It was so dangerous. Like, I graduated high school in 1997, and I looked at Pratt for college. And I went to when you went to visit all the colleges that, you know, that spring of your junior year. And I looked at Pratt, and I was very mainstream, normal art student. I wasn't looking at, like, an artsy-fartsy type school situation. Like, I wasn't into it. I was very, preppy. You know, I didn't really. But I went to Pratt, and my I took a tour, and everybody in the tour group was like super artsy type people, piercings, tattoos, goth. Yeah. So I felt very out of place. And our tour guide was this really cute girl with a shaved head and covered in piercings. I was like, I don't think I'm going to fit in here at all. Like, I wasn't against art school, but I just didn't.
It was a shock thing.
But it was, at the time, it was also very off-putting. The amount of razor wire going around the perimeter of the school was just like, I feel unsafe here.
Well, did everyone from the group make it back? Like, was there a head count?
Yeah, they counted heads, but they weren't all attached to bodies.
Yeah. There was a movie by the guy who made Ghost World, Dan Crowles, I think his name is, who did Ghost World, and he did Art School Confidential after that, and that was based on Pratt. Mm. I mean, to a T, you know, all the freaks and stuff, and a lot of inside jokes. It's actually pretty good.
What was going to Pratt like?
You know, it really was at times a little scary, but it was very inspirational.
You know, you seem very, dare I say, normal-ish for an artist.
No,
or are
I'm
you
eccentric.
Kind of like a quiet crazy?
No, I'm not very social. I'm not. I didn't fit in totally. It's really great place for it's like the island of misfits.
Mm,
it really is. And but it was very inspirational. The work was exceptional. There were times that people who came through, you knew the names. You'd see people in your class get published in the New York Times, let's say, in the book review or something, and all of a sudden it's like you're close to it. Yeah, you really feel like you're in the minor leagues, and it's just a little bit of ways to the big show. Then that's why you go there. When I finished school there, I immediately started teaching there. I taught there. And I taught at SVA for about 10 years. I went to FIT for a semester because it was all girls. I was like, me and a gay man named Dennis was in the classroom.
Just you and Dennis?
That was just me and Dennis.
Is that how you met your wife?
No, that's how I started a relationship with Dennis.
Oh.
The plan was to just go somewhere I could finally...
The wife doesn't know this part.
Right. No, I am married now, but those are just good times.
Those were crazy art days.
Exactly.
So you taught at Pratt, SVA, and FIT?
No, at FIT I was just a student slash stalker.
Mm, yeah.
And just hanging out, Googling. I mean, I went there for fine art, actually, because there was a period in which I wanted to do fine art painting.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's why I went to FIT, because they had a teacher who I admired, who was a fine artist. And I would go there after working at the Village Voice. I'd work at the Village Voice all night. And this is when I used to drink. I don't drink now, but for health reasons, I try to be a little healthier. But at the time, I'd finish up around 5, 6 a.m. in the morning, after doing cartoons for The Voice, have some beers, and then go over to my 9 o'clock class at FIT, where I would paint from 9 o'clock until the afternoon, and then start all over again.
So what kind of painting did you used to do?
I used to do abstract paintings.
Okay.
So I was doing a little of everything. I wasn't really sure what I wanted. And what I do now is totally different from what I did back then because, I didn't know. I was just kind of experimenting and trying to find a place. I was under the impression that you just kind of make these paper airplanes And you just toss them out the window. You just see what sticks. And what I'm doing now is what sticks. It kind of, somebody picked it up. Other things kind of got discarded. I mean, I stopped doing abstract paintings only because maybe if I had a whole bunch of, you know, galleries showing my work, I'd probably still be doing that.
What were the abstract paintings? Like, what were the subject matters? Were they people?
No, there was just, I still am a real big fan of abstract art. So it was just nothing subjective. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, that crap you see where it's just a square and then a dot.
So you just do squares and dots?
It's so much easier. You know, what I did was, you work
it
like
it does
that.
Look, when you go to like, you know, you go to MoMA or whatever.
Yeah.
And people are always like, you know, jackass type folks, I could do that. You could do that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, people say that and you're like, ah, what an asshole. No, you actually could do that. Do it. And you could sell it for $50,000. Yeah, but
no, the key is this. The key is if you work really small and if you work like the scale of a 2-foot by 3-foot canvas, if you go to a 16-foot canvas, that's half of it right there. Yeah. You just have to know the stretch of the canvas really, really big.
Yeah.
And then most of the work is done.
Yeah.
And it's all. And
people are pretty much just buying the canvas.
So I learned early on to do everything like the half-ass way. If you could do like, let's say, a subject matter of snowmen. Now, I got into snowmen. I'm a snowman expert.
Yes, you are a snowman expert. Your other book is The History of Snowmen.
Correct. It's actually out of print at the moment, and it's gonna come back, hopefully.
Can I buy it digitally for my tablet on Amazon?
Yeah, I think it's actually, I've been giving them away for free. I think the publisher and I agreed that we gave out like a million copies of ebooks on it because we just want people to enjoy it.
Yeah.
But we're going to come out with a new version of it that's like a really nice coffee table book.
Will it be a sequel or the same book?
It's going to be somewhat of a sequel. It's going to be an updated thing because there's been actually some big snowman news. I just reported on that in the New Yorker.
What is website. The big snowman news?
No, there's always developments in snowman world. I mean, there's people who are making it as modern art. There's people who are going to do other things. I mean, because the snowman is a poster boy for global warming. So it's sort of like the duck-billed
platypus. So it's like seeing that, it's like seeing the polar bear.
Exactly.
I mean, in snow.
I mean, the snowman itself, I mean, it sounds like I'm being, you know, flippant, but the truth is that it is one of man's earliest forms of folk art. And it was in the Middle Ages an early form of pornography and political commentary when people used to go out in the streets and make snowmen in these like political scenes on the street corner or very graphic sexual scenes.
Of snowmen?
Yeah, and people couldn't read and stuff. So this was a way of communicating and sort of like venting their, you know, sometimes their confusion or their outrage toward the church or the government or not being able to understand this thing called sex and not getting their hands around it. And they did
put their hands around that.
And they did it for showing snowmen. And this was a way.
I've seen some pretty graphic pictures of snowmen.
Well, this is not just giant penises. I'm saying back then they actually showed things that were like sort of trying to, you know, get rid of their urges in that time when everyone was so anxious about everything. I mean, everyone was dying left and right in the Black Plague.
Yeah.
And it really was not a great time, but, you know, it could be brightening up your day if you go out and make a snowman.
It brightens up every day, even the Black Plague.
And back then, actually, artists used to make snowmen. Like Michelangelo made a snowman. He was commissioned to make one for a prince.
How do you have records of that?
No, I'm just making those all up. This is
That's fine. Is this all in the book?
Yeah, it's all. The whole book is fiction. No, the book is really. The way I did the book though is, I collected a team of experts from around the world. I traveled around the world for about 7 years. I had professors of cultural history. I had art historians helping me. I even hired students for Columbia University to translate old diaries from the Dark Ages to find passages in which people made snowmen. So what I did was I studied old journals and diaries. And I also went to, like one example is I went to the Royal Library at The Hague. And I spent a few days there examining their largest image collection. There's like 8 million images.
Pretty cheery bunch over there at The Hague.
It is. They're very nice. And I studied the illuminated manuscripts. And I found the illustration of a snowman in the
There is an illustration of a snowman in the illustrated manuscripts at the Hague?
There's one example from 1380 alongside a solemn passage of the crucifixion of Christ. And the snowman is there and tells a story and stuff. And
so, is it a traditional three-ball snowman?
Well, it's two balls. I mean, there are different cultures in which two balls are better than the three.
Okay.
In Japan, a two-ball snowman is actually a good luck charm. And in the case of this image, it was two balls, and the snowman was melting. And it's an anti-Semitic message, because we know that because of the hat he's wearing. Mm. The hat is used as symbolism for all the Gothic paintings. Anytime they wanted to depict someone Jewish and they wanted to be anti-Semitic, in a lot of cases, it would be a depiction of Jesus on the cross, and it would be someone Jewish bringing him a sponge soaked in vinegar.
And they would have the guy wearing a hat?
They would have him a very specific hat. Mm. And this was a clue to who that person was. And there's a whole system.
It sounds complicated.
People were horrible back then.
Yeah, unlike now. Today, people are great.
We learned.
Yeah, we learned.
We grew.
So there's a new Snowman book coming out.
Well, hopefully.
In the works.
It's in the works.
The current footnotes from the world's greatest bookstores has a foreword from Garrison Keillor.
Right.
From Prairie Home Companion. Yeah, how'd you score that? Do you know him?
He's a fan of my work. He was very nice. I approached him, and he told me that he had known my cartoons, and I went to see him perform. They called me up. Right after the show, I got called up on stage. And my story with him is I went backstage to meet him in the dressing room, and it was just like the regular scenes you imagine from those old Hollywood movies, mm-hmm. where there's flowers and there's those big light bulbs around the mirror.
Yeah.
And there's all these hanger-ons that you go, these women who are a little bit older with these long cigarettes. And there was like about 13 people in this room when I first approached the doorway. And as I approached, he was having a temper tantrum.
Really?
Like a Joan Crawford sort of thing. And he actually threw everyone out of the room before I had a chance to say hello to him. And as we're all leaving, he goes, no, not you, Bob. And he called me back in.
Bob gets to stay.
Bob gets to stay. And I took off my clothes. And for about 30 minutes, we talked about comedy. And during that time, I was just totally like nervous and really couldn't get past the fact that I was in front of someone who I consider like sort of the Mark Twain of our generation.
He's a big guy, too.
He's really big.
Booming voice.
Yeah, he has a big presence, and he had a bow tie on, only a bow tie.
Ooh.
And a really big guy, like you said. And he was able to ad lib. The impressive thing was is he's really funny, where he was able to just, he's just had really great comebacks to anything I would say. And as I watched him perform actually earlier, I was very impressed by the fact that everybody was on script. Everyone had pages,
mm-hmm.
and he memorized most of the show.
That's a lot of stuff.
He really is talented. I know a lot. Yeah. He gets a lot of bad rap about people.
He can sing. He can do comedy.
No, that's not true. He can't sing.
He can't sing?
And that's a real big drawback, because people do beat up on his singing. But he's really funny, and he does a great storyteller.
Maybe he can't sing, but right. He does sing.
He's a great storyteller, and his writing is really strong, and he inspired me. And I really thought he was the perfect person for the book. We talked about who should be doing the introduction, and I wanted Tom Hanks, but I wasn't able to reach him.
Mm-hmm.
And then we wanted Oprah, but Oprah is actually a little bit polarizing, so we felt Garrison Keillor would be best. And I'm really, really excited he's in the book.
Yeah, he's not polarizing. Either people know him or they don't know him. Period.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It isn't like, oh, I don't like what Garrison Keillor said about this.
He actually owns a bookstore, too.
Does he?
Yeah, he owns one in Minnesota. So he's a good fit, and he's a guy who's like supported writers. He's had these like different scholarships for people who are students who are upcoming poets and writers. So he's very involved in the community.
He's a very literary person.
Yeah.
Yeah, he can read. It's good. So, well, you work digitally now.
I work digitally. I mean,
you started out painting.
Right. I mean, there's times in which I did do some of the bookstores with traditional material.
Mm-hmm.
And going forward, I'd like to, because I want to have an art show of the artwork.
That's the problem. That's what I'm finding. Like, it is easier to do stuff digitally.
Yeah.
But then you don't have it. Like, you don't have that, like, that piece of paper that you can hang on your wall that's like, a watercolor or an oil painting or a drawing. Like, you don't have it any. Like, someone will say, well, send me the original. I'm like, I can send you a PSD file. And that's just, like, so less romantic, you know, of being an artist.
But we're doing so much more work now, too. I mean, if I was going to do 75 large canvases, logistically, it's a problem. And if I'm doing one bookstore a day, I mean, it's hard to get everything done and scan it and send it in. And then I have text over my artwork, and that has to be changed to different languages.
Yeah.
So there's, like, some production things to address. And I do want to do things on canvas going forward, because some people said, oh, well, it will look different. It won't look different, because I've been doing this for many years.
Yeah.
And I do both.
Well, would you be doing this? Would this be oil?
Yeah.
If you were to do this?
I'd like to do some pastel and some oil. I already have the materials, and I've been doing work on it. But again, it does present some headaches, like where I'm going to keep all this work and do it quickly. I mean, there are times in which I did it on the road. Yeah,
storing stuff is definitely – I have so many stacks and stacks of drawings and paintings and things. And, like, I can't get rid of it, but I, you know, I can't put it anywhere in, like, you know, flat storage type things. They're just so big, and they just take up so much space, and I don't know. This is gorgeous. This book's amazing.
No, I had a lot of fun doing it. I mean,
how long did this take to do all these? I mean,
about a year and a half. And then some of them were done over and over, because, like, sometimes I would do a piece and I wouldn't be totally happy with the way it looked. So I would give it another shot. But another times I felt like I captured it the right way the first time. So it's a hit and miss. I know that I want to do more, because the stores that I cut out, half the stores I cut out, which I did, they weren't too pleased. You know,
Stores in this, other than Book Court, do you know of stores that have closed since this book came out?
Yeah. I mean, there was this one store that was, there's a really heartbreaking story. This store called Moby Dickens in New Mexico.
It's good.
And that was pretty clever. Yeah. And I knew they belonged in the book. They did a lot of community stuff. They were, you know, a great bookstore. So they write me back saying, listen, I'm sorry that we didn't get back to you. We told you we'd get back to you like 2 weeks ago. And we just have to explain that in the time that we last spoke to you, we went bankrupt.
Mm.
They took the time to like write me, and it's like, oh God, you gotta be joking. It's like,
sorry, we're out of business.
I know. It's like, it's really upsetting.
Yeah.
I mean, but at the same time, I've helped. I mean, I do know that there's been some progress, and I mean, I'm not trying to be so like grandiose that I think that my book makes a difference, but I did do some things I feel happy about. For instance, there was this store that was closing in Toronto. There's a couple, and they wrote to me saying that they love my book, even though they're not in it, but that their husband was dying of lung cancer, and it was a dying wish to have me illustrate his store. So I said to him, no, go fuck off.
Yeah, obviously.
And then somebody heard that and said, no, you got to do this.
Yeah, probably.
And I did the piece, and then somehow the Daily Globe and Mail saw it, and they wrote a story about me doing the illustration. And what happened was is that attracted investors to help them out money-wise to keep the store afloat. And then they even got a couple of doctors who said that they might be able to help finding a lung transplant. And right now, the guy is like keeping stable, and he's not passed away. And this was in Christmas. The store closed, and the store is dead, but the owner is still alive, and that's more important.
Yeah.
And it really has been really great. And I've made friends with them. And
they're in the book?
They're not in the book. They have nothing to do with the book. It's just an example, though, of how I've made a lot of like really special friendships with people through the book.
Is there which page is the Barnes & Noble? Where's that? Is that in here?
You're not helping. You see?
Is there an Amazon.com store illustration in here?
Well, no? That's an ongoing thing that I've been writing about Amazon.com, how it affects these bookstore owners, because these bookstore owners are paying the taxes for the local post offices and schools and police, and Amazon can lower their prices as low as they want. In this country, in Europe, they're protected. Mm. And that's why bookstores are able to flourish. But as far as Barnes & Nobles go, you know, I definitely appreciate Barnes & Nobles a lot. And I make a point in the book and also in
They sell your book.
they sold my book. They've been great. And the reason I want to say something about Barnes & Noble is because I learned how much charity they do. They really do help a lot of people. For instance, hospitals that all have libraries, those books come from Barnes & Noble's
Really?
Donating. Barnes & Noble actually helps the publishing field a lot.
Yeah.
As opposed to Amazon, Barnes & Noble is responsible for a lot of people getting their first chance writing. And the way they do that is because they're the ones who give advances to publishing houses, which in turn go toward advances for publishing houses to take risk on unknown people. I mean, if it wasn't for, let's say, that system, all you would have is cookbooks and cat books. And right now it's like 90% that way now, but yeah. That 10% wouldn't even
diet
exist.
Diet books.
Yeah. I mean, really, those are the best sellers. I was just at a book event where the manager says, let me show you our bestseller. And it was a collection of internet cat pictures.
I saw a book on a stoop recently. I took a photo of it and I put it on the Instagram. But the book was ridiculous. It was called Crafting with Cat Hair.
Yes, I saw that. That inspired me. I want to do a book with
it's
you.
It's a real book. We should do
appetizers for cats.
A cookbook
/ cat book is what is needed.
Yeah. A cook.
I saw that book, though. You saw it.
Yeah. It was on a stoop. Someone was giving it away. I should have taken it because I couldn't believe it existed.
The only thing sad, it would be seeing my book there for like a quarter.
Like cheaper than the cat hair book.
Yeah.
If you buy the cat hair book, you get footnotes from the world's greatest bookstores for free.
People who like that like this.
You must like snowmen if you like cat hair crafts. So you got out of Pratt, you went to FIT, you worked at SVA, and then what was your first job, your first accepted illustration when you got out of school as an illustrator? Because I went to Syracuse, I studied illustration.
Yeah.
I would cart around my portfolio in New York City. I dropped it off on art. I think it was like art direction days. You could talk to the art director by dropping off your portfolio and like this.
Right.
They wouldn't let you go in the front door. You had to go in the back door where like the service entry was. And then it would be, Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You could drop off your portfolio and then you could pick it up the next day from the same service entrance. And that's how, nowadays it's all email or web stuff. But back in the day, you had to drop off your portfolio.
Yeah, I did the same thing. The first thing I did was I went to the New York Times. I actually went as a student. While I was still a student at Pratt, I did have a full page. I got a full page illustration at the Times. Sorry.
Really?
I mean, I have to explain my career.
That's very good. I got a very nice full page rejection letter from the New York Times when I first got out of college.
My career peaked when I was a student. Right now my work has got, I'm struggling more and more, and I'm not joking. It was much easier when I first started. I did work for the book review. And then while I was still a teenager, I did a column for Newsday. I wrote a humor column for the TV guide section. And that sort of led to other things where I was writing humor for different magazines. So I was lucky, and it became more and more difficult as time went on. And as also the publishing field became more and more like the Titanic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but the first place I would say I ever got published was when I was really young. There was an underground magazine called The Bob, which covered all these bands who I'm a huge fan of, and I got to know through this magazine. They used to give these flexi discs, these like really loose like pieces of plastic that you could play in your phonograph, and it was like the first song by Echo and the Bunnymen, or like Devo, and those are the groups that were give you an idea how old I am, and this underground, fanzine would be called.
Mm-hmm.
Covered the new wave and the punk scene. I was really into the Dead Kennedys, and I would go to see them in concert, and so I did cartoons for them. They gave me like a space, and then there was the Newsday thing, and I did columns for some other magazines and stuff, and that's where I got my chops. It wasn't until much later that I did cartoons at all, really, like gag cartoons for the New Yorker. That was just a dare in 2007. Sam Gross took me out for my birthday.
Now, how did you meet Sam Gross?
I hired him to be in my snowman book. My snowman book has an intermission because as I was writing all this history, I decided there's no way people are getting to the halfway point without just chucking this book. I mean, people are going to get bored about snowmen.
Yeah.
So what I'll do is I'll make an intermission and have the world's greatest snowman cartoons. So I went to the New Yorker, and that was my first exposure to really the New Yorker cartoons. I really wasn't paying much attention to it, except for I did the contest, like the first time they did the caption contest.
Yeah.
And I actually came in second place on that.
That's good.
Yeah, it was like a Quasimodo cartoon. The doctor was coming in, and the patient, something about the patient not knowing who the doctor's name was and saying, but the name rings a bell. It's like the most corny joke in the world.
It's pretty good.
Hey, Vay. So, so Sam took me out to lunch after I had bought his cartoon from my book. And after buying his cartoon, we kind of corresponded. I bought like two cartoons. I think maybe he knew my humor from writing in magazines. And I did a piece. I wrote a piece for National Lampoon when he was there.
Mm-hmm.
So he was familiar with me. So, and I went to lunch and had a good time. Like, the food was good, and I met Gaham Wilson and some other people who I admire.
Yeah, wow.
So I asked if I could come back, and he said, well, yeah, but come back with 10 sketches. So, and I couldn't. I tried for 1 week, but in 2 weeks, I came back with 10 sketches. It took me like the full 2 weeks to go back, and I showed up, and he introduced me to Bob Mankoff. And he told Bob, there's this guy who won't leave me alone. Can you take a quick look at his sketches? And Bob actually bought the first cartoon that I drew in this batch.
And what was that?
It was Hecklers on Poetry Night. And I wrote this joke with my writing partner. At the time, my best friend was my writing partner. And you might know him, Len Belzer. Len Belzer was the host of the NPR Comedy Hour.
Is that related to the other Belzer?
Yeah, that was his brother.
Okay.
And I knew Richard.
Yeah.
And because of that, because of the brothers, I also got a chance to know other people like Larry Miller, and they were friends with Robin Williams, George Carlin, and it opened up the world to me.
Yeah.
And I became a comedy geek.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would go to, I did a couple of open mics.
Really?
And he did too. And his brother was someone who I was in touch with. So it kind of opened up that world of comedy. It got me more serious about it. Unfortunately, he's not with us. He actually committed suicide. Around the same time, Robin committed suicide, which is actually related, because I believe that when Len committed suicide, it gave Robin the courage to follow through. He always had these urges and kind of pushed him. It's kind of the last straw. So it's, sorry to bring down the podcast.
Yeah.
But
pretty cheery over here, Bob.
So Bob bought a cartoon from me. I thought, okay, well, this is easy enough. I mean, I was in a room with 12 people. I assumed that everyone in the room sold a few cartoons and that I did really poorly. And I thought that, you know, I'll do better next time.
Yeah.
And that if I just have to work harder. And I started studying the New Yorker and doing better that way. I could see the improvement in my work. And the cartoon, by the way, was Hecklers on Poetry Night. And you had these guys screaming from the audience. You call that a metaphor? And, you know, nice something if you're in a coma. So I don't know, some silly thing. But anyway, what I learned was that it was just...
Nice stands. Is it stands or stanza?
Yeah. Oh, I think I made a meter joke.
That's a Shakespearean thing, I think. Stanza. I don't know.
You just lost half the crowd.
Yes. Our two listeners have gone down to one listener. Hi, Mom.
You brought up Billy Shakespeare. Oh, anyway, I learned that it was just beginner's luck, and then it took a year before I sold like my second cartoon.
So what's the formula for putting together a gag cartoon for The New Yorker? Like, you start with an idea. What sparks the idea? And then... what's the process of making the cartoon that you then send in?
You know, I was just asked to write about this for a magazine, Writer's Digest. Like, where do you get the ideas? And what I said was, it's just an inspiration from anywhere. It could be like something that happened to you in eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
It could be some woman talking to her dog in front of your building, and she says something just crazy.
Has anything happened today that you're rattling around?
Yeah,
a joke
Yeah. I wrote it down. It was something. Yes, there was Mark Maron was on the podcast talking about cat mugs. And I thought to myself, you know, the biggest bestsellers now are just cat books and cookbooks and maybe cat calendars and cat mugs. And I should do a cartoon about that. And then it led me to think, well, what's happening to bookstores? And then it made me think of the joke of a person, not a joke yet, it's just a work in progress, somebody coming up to the cashier to buy a book, and the person saying something like, would you like fries with that? And that will sort of lead to something else, maybe.
Yeah.
But basically, the ideas are basically, start off as a bad joke, and then you try to improve it, and then you just riff on it until it becomes something that is actually something. But it's seldom that a joke comes off perfect the first.
So maybe the cartoon you're going to do is going to be the ultimate bestseller cat cookbook.
Right. But that in itself maybe needs to be served up in a better way that feels like a cartoon.
Yeah.
So I'll just keep on writing and jotting down things until something becomes something that's funnier. Another joke I came up with recently, which was a failure at first, was a highway scene. And on the highway, it said on top, vacation. So you're going on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
But then the exit sign said staycation. So I thought, all right, well, that's the beginning of something. It's kind of amusing, but it's not really makes you laugh. So I try to think, how can I improve this? How can it be twisted around? And then I think it was actually a friend who said, I was saying this out loud in a diner. He said, well, why don't you make the exit ramp go in a U-turn right back on the highway? That would be more logical. So he had realism to it. So he said this, and then I realized there's not really much of a joke there. But that's how I would...
Maybe the guy's car is just a couch.
Could be.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean,
look at us riffing. We're making cartoons right here on the radio.
But now we're getting into legal things. I have to now cut the rate with you. We have to discuss...
Now you can have it. I'm giving that to you. That's fun. It's all yours.
If it was a really good joke, we'd be in litigation now.
Yeah. Like Sam. I mean, doesn't Sam sue everybody for use of, is it the frog's legs?
Yeah. I mean, he just sold that cartoon on eBay for like $20,000.
The original?
Yeah.
Wow.
The original, you said, with air quotes.
Yeah. Try the frog's legs.
He sold the 5 originals
online. Oh, really?
No.
Is that true?
No. He sold the one, and I think maybe that cartoon would get more than any other cartoon I could think of. Like, that's kind of got like a legend behind it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was at his house, and he has like a museum when you first walk in of cartoonist work that he took from the people who worked under him. And it includes my buddy Nick Downs has a cartoon in his foyer. It was Santa Claus descending. No, he's going away from the house. He's going up the back up the chimney. And the Timmy sees him, and he says, Timmy, now I'm going to have to kill you. That was a National Lampoon cartoon.
Yeah?
Well, one of the best.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
So the show is called Talkward because you're supposed to tell awkward stories. So what's an awkward thing that's happened to you recently? Do you have a good awkward story for me?
Well,
you seem like someone who has lots of awkward things.
Yeah. First, thank you for giving me some heads up.
No problem.
Come up with a story.
Yeah.
Thanks for putting me on the spot. Yeah. Here's one. Okay, a friend was coming down to a book event, and this was at Book Culture, and he shows up with his agent, his editor, the publisher, and his wife, and they were going to be interviewing each other. The editor and the agent were going to kind of sort of do a panel about his new book that came out, and there's only 2 people who showed up in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So for a brief moment, they discuss where they're going to continue. And they decided to go ahead because the owner of the bookstore was filming it for Facebook. So they said, you got to do it. So halfway through this book event, as they're staring at me, the other person gets up, right? The other person's Oliver Stone. Okay, he gets up and slowly puts on his scarf and his hat and his coat. And so half the audience is walking out of this book event, leaving me to listen for 45 minutes about the George McGovern years of World War II.
You're like, Oliver Stone, take me with you.
Okay. Awkward moment. Let's do some Q&A now. Okay? I'm the only person in the audience. I am not exaggerating. So a week later, I'm in that exact same bookstore, and thank God people showed up to my book events. So it was a nice sized crowd, very happy. Of course, I had family there to pad the audience. Yeah. You know, so it was really nice. So the first thing I did was ask anyone here. I said, was anyone here last week? I said, let me rephrase that. Is Oliver Stone here?
Was he?
No. Oliver Stone, I guess, was there to consider the movie rights of George McGovern's life.
I guess suppose. He decided no.
Oh, that's a bitter pill.
You know what? This is boring. I'm out. Oliver Stone's out.
Don't leave me here, yeah. Oliver.
Take me. That's awesome. This is fun.
I guess. I hope.
Oh, yeah. I'll cut this down. It'll be 14 minutes, 10 minutes.
I gave you about 30 seconds of good story.
Yeah, absolutely. We can cut this down to just the vowels, and it'll be hilarious.
You said we have to do this in Spanish?
Yeah, we're going to do this again in Spanish and in French.
Okay, I'm going to tell you my Regents grade. I took my Spanish Regents after 4 years of Spanish. I'm told I had the lowest grade of 14.
14 out of?
100.
Wow, that's pretty low.
I was only able to say, they're going to the beach. That was the only thing I could. There was like an oral part where I had to say like these different conversation, and I couldn't do anything on the test. The test was like 90% like written test, but I don't read Spanish, so I couldn't understand any of it really.
Yeah. So what's coming up next?
I go from here. I'm supposed to meet a friend for lunch at 2:30, and then I was going to go to the gym.
That sounds like a big... And you're an avid tennis player.
Yeah, I play up at Columbia University, and I get a chance to play... I actually play ranked players. It's a lot of fun. It's keeping me active from just getting really cranky, and that's how I'm dealing with the new administration.
Have you always played tennis?
Yeah, I actually went to school at Pratt on a tennis scholarship over there.
Pratt has a tennis scholarship?
Yeah, I went...
Really?
A full scholarship.
On tennis?
Yeah.
The art school.
Well, you know,
tennis scholarship.
I wasn't going to go to school if it didn't pay my way. I was broke. I grew up very poor. We grew up in the South Bronx, and I didn't finish high school. I didn't go to my senior year. I started going to Pratt. I had a girlfriend who told me, she explained how you can sit in on classes in college because no one takes attendance. So I was going to Pratt in Columbia. Well, I was supposed to be going to high school, and I was sneaking. And then what happened was, is I took the home exam test to try to get in. And at the same time, I learned tennis from a friend who was very good, who went on the pro tour. And I got some tennis scholarships from a few schools. So I had some choices. I wanted to go to Pratt because I was going to the classes and I enjoyed the classroom. I actually asked the teacher for a letter of recommendation for my admission. So the teacher was able to say he did well in the class. Can he go to college here? Can he officially go?
Yeah.
And then I was able to get the money from my playing tennis. And then I was serious into tennis. I was an instructor, and that's how I made money after college. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I did was I taught tennis.
My dad was a tennis instructor.
Oh, get out, really?
That's how he met my mom. Yeah. He went to Florida State for tennis and soccer. And he would teach tennis, but both my parents were from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Mount Lebanon. And my dad would teach tennis.
That's Trump country.
Is it?
Trump represents the people of Pittsburgh, not Paris.
It's funny, though. If you heard the mayor of Pittsburgh was like, no, we're going to follow the Paris Accord. And
that is cool.
Yeah.
I guess
all these other mayors... There was like hundreds of mayors all went to Paris for some big meeting, and they're all following the Paris Accord within their cities.
Yeah.
They're just doing it anyway. And so is de Blasio. So is New York. They're all just like, we'll just do it. We're good. We don't need to be told that we aren't going to be environmentally friendly.
Well, that's really cool to hear.
Yeah.
Does your dad still play tennis?
He doesn't play anymore. Because of his eyes, and he can't see as well. But he played up until, and now he swims. That's how he gets his exercise. But yeah, he taught. He played tennis. He played.
That's
he taught.
So cool. Did you play at all?
I'm absolutely terrible. I was a huge disappointment.
Because if you ever want to play, we can go on the court. And
I'll
can
play.
Give you some tips. Yeah, we could do it just for fun.
But I'll be terrible.
We have to play for money, but that'd be
sure.
Fun. Yeah.
Do you play golf?
I used to play golf a lot.
You play golf.
My awkward story was the only job I ever had, I worked at a golf course as a starter. It lasted 3 hours. The owner of the golf course came down in the golf cart and said, "We don't employ people who are on drugs." I was like,
"What were you on?"
I was actually not on drugs. I was joking. I was joking with the other golfers, and we were all having a good time laughing. And this bugged the owner.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, this is when I was like 18. And I said, you know what? I'm never going to have a real job. I said, if I can help it, I'm not going to work for somebody. And I have to say, I'm proud that I've kept that pledge.
Yeah.
That I've never, yeah.
You've never had a boss?
I've never really had a boss. I always worked freelance. I always worked. I like to say I'm just like Victoria's Secret models. We work in our underwear.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you do, I mean, you do your Mad Magazine illustrator.
Yeah.
Playboy?
Well, I used to do
Playboy. Started doing cartoons again. They stopped.
They just started again, but it just started. They were in sabbatical for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And I do have like a nice note from Hugh Hefner that I'm fond of. And they bought a couple of my cartoons. But before I was being a smartass and you asked me what I'm doing next, right now I'm actually working on a piece about the U.S. Open. You should tell your dad. It's for Esquire magazine.
Okay.
And it's going to be, it's hopefully a jokey thing. It's about the changes in the rules. They're going to change the rules.
Because Esquire just launched an entire humor section, right?
Yeah, it's a whole
Mankoff.
It's a total makeover.
Moved from New Yorker.
Yeah.
Started in it. So are they basically doing a Shouts and Murmurs New Yorker cartoon-esque section of Esquire?
They don't even know themselves, I'm sure, because it's sort of like they're still feeling out like what they're going to be. But I think they're going to definitely try to take advantage of Mankoff's cachet.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to try to make it seem like here's a little more new blood for Esquire. Like we're going to usher in a new, Esquire.
Well, I mean, they need it. I mean, the most popular part of the New Yorker is the comedy parts and the cartoons. In my opinion.
I don't know if they want to admit that, but you're right. I would agree with you.
That's the stuff I read is the Shouts and Murmurs and the cartoons.
Right.
And any part of Esquire that does that is going to get more views, obviously. And the best part of, I mean, I think everything, I don't know, are there very many places to submit cartoons right now?
I submit to about 20 places, and they're all like really not using cartoons much at all. I mean, there used to be Reader's Digest.
Yeah. They stopped?
They kind of stopped. Harvard Business Review used to be a place I used to run cartoons. I do a lot of cartoons for England. And in England, there's like four magazines I work for. But you were talking about American markets. There's not much.
Yeah.
It's really, I don't know why. I mean, I always wondered, why don't people kind of copy the New Yorker business model and try to do something similar where they disperse like cartoons throughout? Because obviously it's so popular with people. Everyone always talks about the New Yorker cartoon. So why isn't that something that people kind of copied?
That format is exactly what Lampoon used to do in the magazine too. Like they would pepper in cartoons.
Yeah.
Every couple of pages within the articles, there would just be a cartoon. You know, it wasn't related to anything on the page. It would just be a cartoon.
Absolutely. And it was famous for some of the cartoons. I haven't burned in my memory now. Some of the cartoons still stand out.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, like Playboy would do that too. I mean, amongst the articles that were very serious, they would just have a cartoon.
Hugh Hefner was a huge advocate of cartoons.
Yeah.
He brought in some of the top people. And he himself, he liked a cartoon. He used to, draw a little bit and stuff. And I mean, the thing now is like he's around 104 years old or something. I mean,
how long does it take you to complete one illustration for anything? For like if you submit a cartoon to the New Yorker?
In a day. To do the...
Because you do pretty quick stuff. You do live drawing for
the New
York
Times.
Times.
Yeah, I used to do the Super Bowl. And that used to be a lot of fun. And I did the Oscars and stuff like that. And it's a great challenge to like try to come up with something in like 10 minutes.
This is Trump as a Mad Lib cartoon.
This is a good part for the podcast.
I want to
show
make,
things.
Well, no, we'll put them online.
Oh yeah, cool.
I wanted
is a good Trump.
I wanted to make you draw something, but I'm trying to find a piece of paper that's not doesn't have stuff all over it. What would you draw now? Let's see. I'm making you draw something live on the air.
Oh, good God. This is like the worst. No, I don't know even what to begin because my head's in the interview and then I'm thinking, all right. So, I mean, that's just it. You put on a different hat.
You can draw this whole microphone thing.
Oh, God. That's so boring.
I know.
Well, I'm going to draw you. You can continue talking. As we're speaking, we'll...
So you're married. How long have you been married?
I married my mortal enemy from college. We were students who were fighting. Our teachers would hold our work up against each other. And that one time she...
So she's also an artist?
Yeah. She's actually, more successful than I am. She's... Her work is exhibited in museums all around the world. She has pieces in MoMA, Whitney.
Wow.
The Victoria Albert.
What type of art
she's is a it? She's a book artist.
Okay.
And she was a Pratt Institute student. Well, I remember one time she actually stormed the classroom crying when the teacher put our work up against each other. And then we wound up being at a funeral of a mutual friend of ours. And she...
Is that where you picked her up?
Well, those are meat markets.
Funerals.
Everyone looks good. They're wearing black.
Yeah. It's very slimming.
It is. And we met there again after 12 years. And I figured to really get back at her, I proposed. I actually...
And she fell for it.
Yeah. We eloped.
That's cheaper.
To Iceland.
Nice.
In Reykjavik. And that's where we got married. And she hates my cartoons. She's not supportive.
Really?
Well...
So do you show her stuff before you submit it? And she's I hate that. And then
she'll say something supportive like, you're really going to bring that in? Or what was your thinking behind this? Or just sometimes I just like her honesty and she'll just say, you're not funny. You know? So actually that drives me to work harder. She is not crazy about the system of having to bring in the work and do all the work. I mean, in all seriousness. And she would like to see me rewarded for my work instead of having to always have to audition every Tuesday.
That's the thing about submitting cartoons is you have a bunch of cartoons that are done and you submit them and then people say no or yes. It's not like someone says, I'm going to hire you to draw something and then you complete it. You already drew it, right? And you're just like throwing it at them and they're like, no. It's different than like a commission piece or something like that, you know? You've already done the work, and then they just say no to you.
Exactly. And then New Yorker could do anything they want.
Yeah.
Because
you go in on Tuesdays, is it a big crowd to go in for the Tuesday review?
Yeah, it's a crowd. It looks like a Williamsburg food co-op, you know? People are coming, spilling in with their sandals and their wooden hats.
Yeah.
And I'm not joking. It's every hipster because they're the ones who really want to be included in the New York.
How much time does each person get to meet?
Well,
you go through the cartoons, boom, 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 you're done.
If he likes you, you could spend 10 minutes with Bob talking. I usually spend like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Usually I go in there, I scramble up his desk and I storm out.
You just flip everything over.
Yeah. Yeah. Before he was my boss, he was my ping pong partner.
You play ping pong?
Yeah. At one point, I tried to go pro. I wrote about this in the New York Times.
Do you play with Will Shorts ever?
Yeah. I know Will. Yeah.
Yeah. He's puzzle master.
Yeah. He's Mr. Puzzle Master.
He's a very big ping pong guy.
He's a smarty pants.
Is he?
He actually owns this big ping pong center up, I think it's by Rhinebeck, I think.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful facility for playing ping pong. I haven't played since I lost this one tournament. It was really, really traumatic loss, and I haven't played since, really.
You can't go back now. There's no going back.
Well, I learned how bad I was. What happened was I played a certain level, and then I started playing players who are really serious.
Like the people you see on TV, and they're like, boom, boom,
yeah,
boom,
yeah.
Boom, boom.
Well,
boom,
I played boom, this boom, one boom, guy who was a German player with ads on his clothes. I mean, he was sponsored.
Sponsored ping pong player.
And he was not interested at all in being friendly or like meeting me. And that's one of the reasons why I do anything, is that you meet people and you expect a little bit of exchanging pleasantries, not like all of a sudden you find yourself, you know, it was just not pleasant. There was nothing enjoyable about it.
Yeah.
And I, you know.
Do you bring your own paddles?
Oh, yeah. That's the only way you can look good. You have to bring more than one.
Do you have like a little carrying case?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I have a little bag of rosin. You know, you have a little powder.
Huh.
And I stretch.
This is a whole culture.
I had a coach.
You had a ping pong coach?
I was trying to go pro.
Do they say ping pong or table tennis?
I say table tennis because all then right. I like to say, I play tennis now. I don't have to stand on the table. I said, I play real man sports.
Yeah.
Not like you girly men.
Not like that table tennis.
That joke doesn't work if I say ping pong.
It doesn't work at all.
No.
No. But you've hung up your paddles. You're done.
I put my balls away. I have.
You tucked them in.
I have a closet. I have a closet. This enormous laundry bag of brand new ping pong balls that I haven't used. And every time I open my closet door, another tear drops.
Ah, one of these days. Going to dust off those balls.
It is sad because it ended on a bad note. I mean, it's like everything else. It's like when you try to get into these magazines, it never ends well where they say, you've done such a great job. Here's the publication. It's yours now. You own it.
Right. Instead, like you don't get anything.
It always ends with, we'd like to stop using you.
Yeah, once you get accepted, nothing gets better.
No.
It only gets worse.
It's really sad. And at the New Yorker, you know, the competition gets more and more young, and everyone is looking for someone new. And I'm not looking newer.
Well, thank God that the millennials are so damn lazy, though, right? Like, are they really?
I try to distract them.
Yeah, just shiny objects.
Well, what I do is I
give them an app.
We all have
one of those fidget spinners. Just give them a fidget spinner.
We all have each other's email.
Yeah.
Because the magazine does that. They send this mass email to every note. So now I can contact...
All the cartoonists are on one email?
Oh, yeah.
Ugh.
So now I can email everyone.
Does everybody CC everybody else and reply all?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I
that's
bet they
really
do.
Annoying. But I'll do is I like to send like midget porn to everyone. Or just create distractions in the day. Because all of a sudden the day gets away from them.
Yeah.
And that's key. Because you do have to get away from the distractions. You were talking about ideas before. To be helpful for once, you do try to turn off the iPads, get away from the phones. Then you walk out. And I've read books about how walking somewhere alone is a way of getting some of the thoughts in the back of your head heard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sometimes a way of getting an idea in the forefront.
Well, I mean, as a cartoonist, you have to always be thinking of jokes and stuff, and you can't those jokes can't pop in your head if you're constantly looking at your phone. You know? Like, I feel like creativity doesn't happen if you're checking your email.
No, you're absolutely right. Sometimes I overhear something wrong, and that might make an accidental joke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, all that kind of stuff. Like, I have a cartoon someplace that I keep on meaning to submit to the New Yorker, and I just haven't done it. And it's two guys at a bar. And there's children all around them. There's babies all around them. And the one guy goes to the other, who knew the smoking ban would have such hazardous side effects? It's a good gag. And I just haven't submitted it.
Well, you have to submit it with a whole group.
I know.
And you have to send
I need like 10.
Well, you need like 1,000.
Ugh.
So you could send one in being a batch. You have to send one batch in each week to demonstrate your sincerity that you want to do this all the time.
Yeah.
They're not going to take one cartoon from, you know, some guy who's a weatherman in Ohio who wants to say he was in the New Yorker once.
Right.
That's sort of the catch-22.
So you need to be like a regular.
Yeah. Yeah. It's frustrating. They want to hire cartoonists, not people who have a good cartoon idea.
Yeah. Are you in like the calendar or any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I used to be in a lot more when I was in the magazine a lot more frequently. And doing the book, of course, took a lot of time away from doing the cartoons to the level that I should have been doing. So there was a little compromise with that. But I'm in the calendars and I'm in a lot of stuff. And you get some royalties for that, which really come in handy. I mean, you can get like maybe a $12 royalty check.
What?
I have a lap pool in my living room.
I bet.
And I have some a lot of fancy fedoras and sunglasses, fedoras. All from royalties. Yeah.
You could buy
it adds up.
A lot of ping pong balls with that $12.
Yeah.
This was awesome. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thanks, Marty.
This is Bob Eckstein. His new book, Footnotes from the World's Greatest Bookstores, is in bookstores now. Many of those bookstores are in the book. Some are not. You can buy this on Amazon and get free shipping.
That's great, but it'd be great if you want to support your bookstore because...
Definitely go to your local bookstore and get this book, though.
Yeah, they need us.
What is your local bookstore in... Where are you, uptown?
I live up by the Cloisters.
Oh, that's lovely.
So my favorite bookstore in New York City is Strand's, where I kind of had like one of my first sexual experiences.
Right there in the bookstore.
As a teenager, in the back shelves, there's always, like, if you've been to Strand's, you know, there's this like really remote exotic sections that couples hook up with in the back.
Did you touch a boob in Strand?
No, I did something better.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Good times.
Yeah.
It was all done at the romance section.
That will be in the next book.
It was in this book, and the editor said it was too jolting.
You wrote about this experience in the book?
Yeah, we wrote about this particular thing that happened to me in a bookstore, but we decided at the end to cut it out. And not so much because it was too graphic, because there are things in here. There is sex stories in the book. There's really? A couple. But because we just felt that having my voice all of a sudden pop up, that was the jolting part. It was all of a sudden I was sharing a story of my own.
Yeah.
Like I have a Marc Maron story about him discovering sex as well in a bookstore aisle. And the funny story about him was when we were talking about this, he was telling me, he goes, oh, I had a great time. Well, we'll get together and stuff. And I'm really glad I did this because I really want to support bookstores. You know, it was a bookstore that changed my life. I said, okay, why didn't you tell me that story?
That would be a much better story than the one I have in
the
book.
So then he did begin to tell me that story, which is in the book, about how his life got changed from this bookstore owner in the bookstore. And then when I told him how great that story was, he actually turned it into his season finale of Marin.
Really?
On IFC.
That's great.
So that story is also in part in the TV series. And he tells me a little bit more about the story, which is really nice. But he's a really nice guy, by the way. He was preparing to interview the president right before my interview with him. And he's since mentioned me on the show and stuff.
Cool.
And
he told me, so you've been on Marin?
No. He talked about the book.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it would be nice to be on the show, and I hope to do it. But I understand that I'm not the level of celebrity that he's had on.
Yeah, you get to be on my show.
Right. I'm working up.
Yeah, you're working up from the basement.
And then I'm going to be working down.
Yeah.
It's like Ed Norton says in The Honeymooners, always be nice to the people on the way up because you're going to meet the same people on the way down.
Yeah. I'll be here. I'll see you again.
Why don't we get you on Marin? We'll do it together.
That sounds great. Let's do it.
Because you're a podcast, so you guys can talk shop.
Yeah, we can talk about microphones and cords and all kinds of stuff. Headphones.
Yeah,
thank you, Bob Eckstein, for being here on TalkWord. We will see you on the cartoons. I'll
Thanks
post them on the site. It'll be great. And thank you for this beautiful drawing you did. I'll describe it. Bob drew me, and it's me with a thought bubble that says, God, this is boring.
Yeah.
And you have to sign this.
It's funny because it's real.
It's funny because it's true. All right. Thank you. This was fun.